First, continuing to prioritize and build a system of parks, open spaces, and trails. Second, filling the current funding gap for additional land for parks, trails, and open spaces. Third, restoring and protecting waterways, rivers, canals, and streams, adding trees, and operating and maintaining additional acquisitions and new capital improvements to the parks and open space system. Fourth, addressing the increased demand for new parks, mountain park improvements, and protection and restoration of urban waterways. And finally, increasing the ratio of park acres to residents so that anyone can get to a park within a 10-minute walk. To ensure the fulfillment of these goals, the ordinance required the city to create the Parks, Trails, and Open Space Program Fund, or Parks Legacy Fund, and restricted how the monies from the fund could be spent. The permitted uses of Legacy Fund revenue are acquiring additional land for parks, open spaces, and trails, developing, improving, and maintaining new and existing parks, including Denver's mountain parks, open spaces, and trails, restoring and protecting waterways, rivers, canals, and streams, purchasing, planting, and caring for trees, and operating and maintaining any additional acquisitions and capital improvements to the city's parks, mountain parks, and open space. The ordinance then charged Parks and Recreation with the administration of the funds and gave its executive director the authority to create any rules necessary for the proper administration of the program. The ordinance requires an annual report of fund expenditures to city stakeholders, including the mayor, city council, the city auditor, and the Denver Parks and Recreation Advisory Board. Finally, in coordination with the Denver Parks and Recreation Advisory Board, Parks and Recreation must submit a 5-year plan to City Council to show how the department intends to use the revenues from the Legacy Fund. Parks and Recreation manages the city system of approximately 250 urban parks, parkways, and natural areas, totaling over 6,000 acres. Additionally, the department manages more than 14,000 acres of mountain parks, 24 lakes, more than 78,000 trees, over 80 miles of trails, 9 off-leash dog parks, and over 300 athletic fields. The department is composed of 4 divisions, including administration, parks and planning, recreation, and the Denver Golf. As it relates to the Legacy Fund, the administration division develops policies, manages marketing and outreach efforts, administers contracts, and manages the financial activities, including the fund's budget and accounting. Within the Parks and Planning Division, the Planning Design and Group and Construction Group manages the design, construction, and funding program for all park capital improvement projects. As shown on page 3 of the audit report, in 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic significantly impacted the city, including Parks and Recreation's operations and services. In addition to closing recreation centers and golf courses, the department reduced park maintenance schedules and delayed planning, design, and construction projects. Parks laid off more than 1,000 part-time employees, reduced seasonal staff by 55%, and furloughed 74 full-time employees. Further, budget constraints reduced the frequency of mowing, litter and trash removal, timeliness of irrigation repairs, and fewer flower beds planted. Along with other city agencies, Parks and Recreation submitted a reduced general fund budget to mitigate the economic impacts of the pandemic. The department delayed some legacy funded projects until 2021 to accommodate for lower than estimated fund revenue. Parks and Recreation oversees the city's park system through a 20-year strategic plan called the Game Plan for a Healthy City, and legacy funds can expedite the plan's goals. The plan's intent was for Parks and Recreation to comprehensively evaluate the current state of Denver's parks and recreation system. And the vision has four guiding principles: every drop, every person, every dollar, uniquely Denver. As shown on page 5 of the report, there are 25 strategies within the game plan to help the department achieve its goals. In compliance with the Park Legacy Fund ordinance requirement, in June 2019, Parks and Recreation implemented the Denver Parks and Recreation 2A five-year plan 2020 through 2024, which outlines the department's plans for using legacy funds to accelerate implementation of the game plan for a healthy city and the goal to enhance the legacy of green space and outdoor culture that Denver Parks and Recreation will leave for future generations. The plan focuses on two main areas. First, maintaining the legacy focuses on maintenance and improvement of existing park assets. And second, extending the legacy focuses on improving accessibility and opportunity through acquisitions, outdoor recreation, signature projects, and resiliency. Parks and Recreation staff explained that legacy funds are treated the same as all other funding sources, and projects are prioritized through the department's capital improvement planning process. Leadership tries to complete multiple projects at the same time by combining legacy funds, bond funds, and capital improvement project funds. However, legacy fund projects cannot conflict with ordinance requirements such as funding for recreation centers. Staff explained that funding is allocated after projects are selected for completion. In addition to the game plan, Parks has six additional criteria to prioritize the highest needs: equity, sustainability, kids and older adults, partnership, geographic distribution, and safety. A table found on page 8 of the audit report provides greater detail on these criteria. By the end of 2020, the Legacy Fund accrued around $72.6 million in revenue, of which Parks and Recreation spent almost $19 million. In the 2021 budget, about $18.7 million in legacy funds are budgeted for citywide park improvement projects, and about $12.9 million for investments in parkland expansion costs and existing park improvements. The objective of our audit was to determine the extent to which the Department of Parks and Recreation ensures legacy fund dollars are used appropriately to improve and expand the park system and accelerate the implementation of the department's 20-year strategic plan, the Game Plan for a Healthy City. The audit reviewed the department's controls and processes for providing management and oversight over the park's legacy fund and for enhancing and improving Denver's parks. We also evaluated the extent that Parks and Recreation communicates project progress and successes attributed to the legacy fund, as well as how consistently and effectively it allocates expenditures, including administrative costs. The audit reviewed documentation from July 2019 through March 2021. This concludes the background presentation, and Kristen will now present finding one.
Okay, thank Kristen, you. Before you start, are there any questions from the audit committee? Anna, I'd like to go to page 10 where there is the revenues and expenditures chart. And if I could ask Scott, does that mean at the end of 2020, there was over $50 million in the legacy fund that was unspent?
Since Sheila, who's the head of our finance team, she's the director of finance, I will let her take a look at that and possibly provide you an answer.
Yes, that is very true. It was unspent. We have to budget for projects. Projects take a lot of time. And we also have a very robust plan for land acquisition. So there is lots of budget set aside for that, because as you know, there's not a lot of land for sale in Denver. And so we have to have some money so-called banked for that so we can respond quickly. Also, the ordinance was approved in 2018 by the voters. We had to do a five-year plan. So we really didn't get started spending money until at least July, August of 2019. So, and then the pandemic hit, and we actually reduced our expenditures in concern for not having the sales tax come in. So all of that is the combination of why there is that much left.
Thank you, Sheila.
Yeah, thank you, Sheila. Scott, it doesn't look to me like there's anything in the ordinance that would preclude you from spending money on golf course maintenance. And we did have an audit of, the golf course enterprise fund recently. And I got to tell you that over at Wellshire Golf Course, which I'm a regular customer, there's a bridge that everyone has to cross to get to the first tee, including the children that are playing in the first tee. And the planks on that bridge are not in good shape. Last Sunday, I noticed a cottonwood tree had fallen over on a tee box. And as I drove by last night, it was still there. I would hope that you could prioritize more of the maintenance of not just the golf courses, but all the parks, because I think as we go through this, maintenance is a significant issue. So,
yes, we can speak to that. But as you know, Auditor, golf courses are enterprise fund, and the dollars that come into the golf course stay with the golf courses. So we will definitely talk to Scott Ruthlake and try to address the issues that you've brought up, but we can look at it. So thank you for those suggestions.
Well, but I want to be clear. There's nothing that prevents the park's legacy fund dollars from going into the enterprise fund.
Yes. Thank you, Auditor.
Okay. Should we continue?
No, yes. I have a second question.
Sure, you're not ready.
And the question is basically, since you have a surplus fund of roughly around $50 million. Now, have you developed a specific plan to spend the $50 million, or is that being rolled in to the general five-year plan that we spoke about earlier?
There is a five-year plan to spend the dollars, and that has been provided to City Council and others. And so it's just not a $50 million surplus. There is a plan to move forward to spend the legacy dollars.
If I could chime in here, please. There always has been a plan. And as I mentioned before, much of it's banked so that we can acquire land, because that's what the citizens want. And so we have to have a certain amount of money. There's always discussions around what is that right amount. And so you have to have that banked. Land is not cheap in Denver. And so that's one reason. The other reason, like I said, is we started late in 2019. Then we had a pandemic, but everything is budgeted the way it should be. So yes, you're looking at like the cash balance, that's true, but it's all budgeted and it just needs to be spent. Things take time, like contracting, those kind of things. So it just took us a while to get started, but we're started and we're moving along. So that's the reason why much of it is the land acquisition.
You're on, Rudy, you're on mute.
How much have you set aside for land acquisition, just roughly, as a rough guess estimate at this point? I'm just really curious about, because I understand, Sheila, that land acquisition is very pricey and very costly these days, but I just want to get just a general estimate in terms of how much money you're setting aside for land acquisition.
There's approximately $25 million, and then we add at least like $4.5 million each year, depending on how much we spend or don't spend. So,
Yep. Thank you.
And then keep in mind too, that projects take time. So you can set aside $3 million to build a park or whatever that might be. And that's not going to be all spent in that 1 year. Construction and planning and design and all that takes approximately 2 to 3 years. So that's the rest of that, you know, much of that. We're doing the best we can to get those dollars out the door, but there's lots of public process and planning that goes into capital projects.
And what about your staffing? Are you going to staff up since you had like 74 people that you furloughed? Is that part of
the equation? If we could find them and you can find them for us, we'll staff up. I mean, we are having the same problem that the rest of the United States and the world is having, is finding people.
Yeah, I mean, the city.
You know, it's called the Great Resignation of 2021. And we're having the same problems as everyone else. We wish we could find them. We're hiring them as fast as we can.
Right now, as a city, we have about 1,300 full-time employee vacancies as a city. And it for all the departments, it's incredibly challenging. And right now, I believe Parks has approximately 100 full-time positions available. And we're trying our best to recruit, to encourage people to come work for us. But people have an opportunity to, during COVID, people realize that maybe their priorities were in a different place and they decided to either move or move back to be near their family or do other things. And so it has been a real challenge with us. And every week we get additional resignations or people moving within the city for better opportunities. And so it has become a real challenge to keep people, to recruit new people, and just to find anybody that really wants to work in some of these jobs.
Okay, thank you. Can we move on to finding number one?
Thank you. Finding one, beginning on page 12 of the report, states that the Department of Parks and Recreation should improve existing business practices to ensure alignment with the ordinance and leading practices. The first finding contains three sub-findings. Specifically, we discovered the department could improve its existing strategies by adhering to all ordinance requirements, increasing impact and effectiveness through better transparency, and preserving institutional knowledge through succession planning. Subfinding one, beginning on page 12 of the report, states that the Department of Parks and Recreation cannot demonstrate adherence to all ordinance requirements. We found that although the department is following some requirements, it is not following all requirements. For example, we found the department has not sufficiently identified which expenses qualify as administrative and did not submit the annual report to all stakeholders. City ordinance specifies that the 0.25% sales tax increase can only be used on certain types of expenses. Allowable expenses include most related to park acquisition and maintenance, with expenses related to indoor recreation centers not allowed. To determine whether expenses are made according to ordinance requirements, we tested a random sample of 44 supplier invoice transactions. This sample of invoice transactions was chosen from a total of 940 from July 30th, 2019 through May 4th of 2021. After examining the expenditures, we found that all 44 transactions appeared to be spent according to the requirements laid out in ordinance. Although Parks and Recreation is likely spending fund dollars in line with ordinance requirements, we found that its policies and procedures for calculating administrative costs lack sufficient guidance to ensure certain spending thresholds set by ordinance are consistently adhered to. To help ensure that funds are spent for their intended purposes, the ordinance allows the department to use no more than 5% of the annual legacy fund revenue on administrative expenses. Although the department has remained under the 5% cap, staff made two errors when calculating the administrative expenses when the figures were requested by the audit team. At the time of this request, the department did not have any formal guidance defining what should be included as an administrative expense or how to calculate the expenses. In June of 2021, the department created an administrative expense policy. The policy, however, does not include important details necessary for staff to consistently identify and account for administrative expenditures, such as the percentage of allowable expenses to use, how to calculate annual salaries, or how to calculate the ratio between expenditures and revenues, all of which were issues driving the prior miscalculations. According to leading practices, documentation is a necessary part of an effective internal control system. According to the U.S. Government Accountability Office, internal controls are the plans, methods, policies, and procedures used to fulfill the mission, strategic plan, goals, and objectives of the organization. Internal controls serve as the first line of defense in safeguarding assets and help managers achieve desired results through effective stewardship of public resources. Specifically, documentation establishes and communicates the who, what, when, where, and why of internal control implementation to staff and provides a means to retain organizational knowledge and mitigate risk, as well as communicate information to external parties like auditors. By adding greater detail to its administrative cost policy and by having clear guidance on calculating administrative expenses, Parks and Recreation will better be able to ensure compliance with the ordinance by accurately and consistently identifying, calculating, and communicating administrative expense information to stakeholders. We also discovered that the department failed to send the 2019 report of legacy fund expenditures to all stakeholders as required by ordinance. On December 1st of 2020, the communications team, who, per the department, is responsible for distributing the annual report, emailed a link for the publicly available report to all required stakeholders except the auditor. While the report is publicly available, ordinance requires it be sent to all individuals specified. In addition to the ordinance requirement, best practices from the federal government note that management should consider responsibilities to all stakeholders and then establish reporting lines so that the quality information necessary to fulfill these responsibilities, such as maintaining transparency around fund use, is communicated appropriately. Although the report was sent to some stakeholders, the department does not have a policy outlining the process for submitting the report, which may help ensure that a required stakeholder is not left out in the future and that the department is compliant with the ordinance. To address these deficiencies, we developed recommendations 1.1 and 1.2 as seen on page 16 of the report. I'll pause for any comments or questions after reading both recommendations. Recommendation 1.1 states that the Department of Parks and Recreation should revise its current administrative cost policy to reflect how administrative costs should be calculated. The policy and procedure should include, at a minimum, which personnel salaries should be included and at what percentage, and how to consistently identify which other allowable expenses related to administering the legacy fund should be included in the total. The agency agreed to implement this recommendation by March 31st of 2022. Recommendation 1.2 states that the Department of Parks and Recreation should develop, document, and implement a policy and procedure for ensuring the annual report related to legacy fund use is distributed according to city ordinance. The agency agreed to implement this recommendation by March 31st of 2022. At this time, we'd like to open the floor for comments from the agency or the committee.
Any questions from the audit committee?
Yes, I have one.
Go ahead, John.
If I take a look at recommendations 1.1 and 1.2, and we're going into the slow season of the year, it would seem to me that getting this done is something that could, you know, should maybe take 2 to 4 weeks to get aired. And I'm having a little difficulty, and I apologize if I'm missing something. So Scott, please correct me. You know, why does this take until March 31st? It's like the longer you keep things sitting around a desk, they get shuffled around. And from pure efficiency point of view, it's just a question I have.
Yeah.
Scott, I can answer that.
Thank you, Sheila. Go ahead.
Sure. We've already got a really great start. We have a draft going. We just put it out that long because it does involve the city attorney's office, and I don't control their workload, and I don't want them to have to like have to turn it around in like 10 days. But we have a really good start. We're trying to do an SOP that incorporates both of these items. And so it's just a lot of different moving parts and parties. And so that's why we just put it out further. But I do believe it'll be done by the end of December. But
thanks.
I want to make sure we meet the deadlines. I don't want us to put a deadline that's, you know, so close and then we don't meet it.
Just for the record, Scott, I haven't received the 2019 or the 2020 annual report. So I'll look forward to the 2021 report.
Yolanda, I believe you did send out the 2020 report.
Correct. The 2020 report was sent directly to your email, auditor.
I think you're going to have to resend it.
Okay, I will do that.
Maybe resend the original email, Yolanda.
I will do that.
And the 2019 also, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
And just also to make sure everyone knows that the expenses as required by the ordinance are also reported in the budget book, which is online along with our report online too. So just wanted to remind everyone you can see it there.
Okay, should we continue, Kristen?
Thank you. Subfinding 2, beginning on page 17 of the report, states that the Department of Parks and Recreation can increase its impact and effectiveness through better transparency surrounding the Legacy Fund. The department has an internal team that oversees its marketing, communications, media, and social media. The communications team has a policy in place with guidance on communication methods, but the policy has not been updated in over 8 years and does not provide guidance on what content should be communicated to the public. As noted on page 17 of the report, the department is not consistently communicating when projects are being funded with legacy dollars through its website or social media. We reviewed the online content for 42 projects, 32 of which received legacy funds, to determine whether and how communication of legacy fund use was occurring. Of these legacy funded projects, only 3 contained virtual communication related to the legacy fund. We also found that the department is not communicating when legacy funds are used on site, despite the presence of project specific signage for other funding sources. Great Outdoors Colorado is a state run Colorado lottery beneficiary and uses signage to show where dollars are being used. We found several examples of these signs at Denver parks. For Great Outdoors Colorado staff, the signs are used to create a greater sense of transparency, but it's also part of their grant agreement. Park projects funded using the Elevate Denver bond program is also communicated via signage at the parks. The Elevate Denver bond was approved by Denver voters, similar to the Legacy Fund. Continuing on page 18 of the report, best practices from the Government Finance Officers Association say that public participation and stakeholder involvement during planning, design, and construction is important for project success. Although the department involves stakeholders during its decision-making process, we found the communication of progress and success did not typically occur after the initial phases of project initiation. As the department's communication policy indicates that its intent is to create a better informed public, the department could be more transparent during the entirety of a project and should consider communicating project fund sources. To address these deficiencies, we developed recommendations 1.3 and 1.4 as found on page 20 of the report. I'll pause for any comments or questions after reading both recommendations. Recommendation 1.3 states that the Department of Parks and Recreation should conduct and document an analysis of its existing communication plan to ensure it's meeting the department's intended purpose of developing a better informed public. This analysis should include what elements, such as funding sources or project timelines, must be communicated to the public, when they should be communicated, and how frequently the communication should be updated. The agency agreed to implement this recommendation by March 31st of 2022. Recommendation 1.4 states that after completion of the communication policy review in recommendation 1.3, the Department of Parks and Recreation should revise and implement its communication policy to include changes identified in the analysis and to enhance its communication with the public, specifically about legacy funded projects. The agency agreed to implement this recommendation by March 31st of 2022. At this time, we'd like to once again open the floor for comments from the agency or the committee.
Any comments from the committee? Anything to add from Department of Parks and Recreation?
No, thank you for the input, and we are definitely looking at this. So thank you.
All right, let's continue.
Thank you. Subfinding 3, beginning on page 20 of the report, states that the Department of Parks and Recreation should preserve institutional knowledge related to the Park Legacy Fund through succession planning. When we asked for guidelines used by the department to identify which legacy fund expenses are defined as administrative costs, management explained that a former employee may have had document which could not be located and recommended we locate applicable federal guidance online. Also, when asked, management was unaware whether any agendas or documentation existed for meetings where the department discussed the planning and prioritization of projects funded, in part with legacy funds. As noted on page 21 of the report, best practices state that management should define succession plans for key roles to help ensure the entity can continue achieving its objectives as staff lead. The department's plans, methods, policies, and procedures establish a first line of defense towards safeguarding public resources, such as the Park Legacy Fund. Also, documenting important meetings and roles promotes the preservation of institutional knowledge and reduces the risk of only a few individuals having access to this important information. Therefore, Parks and Recreation's approach to documentation, knowledge sharing, and contingency planning for the Parks Legacy Fund may result in inadequate preparation to continue operations and to retain information related to key decisions if and when staff depart their roles. To address these deficiencies, we developed Recommendation 1.5 as found on page 21 of the report. Recommendation 1.5 states that the Department of Parks and Recreation should develop and document plans for succession and contingency planning to ensure the department can continue achieving its objectives when replacing staff over the long term or when sudden personnel changes occur, which could affect the department's ability to meet its objectives, such as those outlined as part of the Parks Legacy Fund ordinance. This should include policies documenting the retention of organizational knowledge to mitigate the risk of knowledge loss, as well as the means to communicate this knowledge to external stakeholders. The agency agreed to implement this recommendation by March 31st of 2022. At this time, we'd like to again open the floor for comments from the agency or the committee.
Any comments, questions from the committee? Any additional comments from the department? Let's move on to finding number two.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and hand it off to Tyson now, who will be discussing finding number two.
Thank you, Kristen. The second finding of the audit, which begins on page 22 of the audit report, is the Department of Parks and Recreation is not ensuring appropriate maintenance of all parks. During our audit, we found the Department of Parks and Recreation is acquiring new park assets with parks legacy funds while not ensuring existing facilities are sufficiently maintained and hazards are quickly identified and corrected. In 2019, the department acquired six properties totaling about 88 acres. One acquisition used about $5 million from the Parks Legacy Fund, and another in 2021 used about $500,000 in legacy funds. Also in 2021, Denver City Council approved the donation of a 450-acre ranch to become a new mountain park, and the city has first right to acquire a nearby 38-acre parcel. In addition to acquisitions, the department partnered with the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure to repurpose city-owned property by developing new parks. While opportunities to acquire new land may be desirable or time-sensitive, the Department of Parks and Recreation may be neglecting existing park assets while expanding the park system with acquisitions, donations, and partnerships. On-site evaluations conducted by both the Auditor's Office and the Department of Parks and Recreation found the condition of existing parks do not meet the department's own evaluation standards, despite the department retaining more than $14 million from 2019 alone in unused legacy funds the department prioritized for acquisitions and park development. In soon-to-follow slides, photos illustrate examples of conditions, including maintenance and safety concerns we found during our evaluations. To conduct these on-site evaluations, we selected 16 facilities from the department's five maintenance districts and mountain parks. Appendix D of the audit report, found on page 55, includes the map illustrating the park maintenance districts. The 16 facilities we evaluated included 10 parks, two dog parks, a park restroom, and two properties newly acquired using legacy funds. We used the department's 2018 park standards evaluation form, which specifies that the standards act as a guide for evaluating parks based on visual inspection of conditions that would be perceptible to the average citizen. The on-site evaluation methodology and testing results are described in greater detail in Appendix C, beginning on page 52 of the report. Evaluation has four categories: general maintenance, park amenity maintenance, horticulture management, and recreation area management. Within each of these categories, individual features are evaluated. Only features present in the park are factored into the evaluation, and an 80% score is required to pass. A graphic illustrating these elements may be found on page 24 of the report. After the audit team completed site evaluations in late June of this year, results found that 6 facilities, or 37.5%, passed the evaluation, and 10 facilities, or 62.5%, failed the evaluation. One example of a park failing to meet the department's own standards is Harvey Park, which failed for reasons including graffiti, trees without mulch, as well as limbs overhanging walkways with insufficient overhead clearance, and dirty restrooms on the 2 consecutive days we visited the park. The evaluation score for Harvey Park was 50%. The Greenway Dog Park in the now named Central Park neighborhood failed with a score of 14% for reasons including trees in poor health, weeds, and a trench of putrid water. While some conditions failed maintenance standards, we also found instances where park conditions are hazardous to humans and animals. In City Park, electrical wires hung across a walkway, creating a trip hazard for pedestrians and cyclists. And we found trenches and holes in Montbello Central Park measuring 36 to 43 inches deep, which were without barricades and were accessible to visitors and animals. However, city ordinance requires any hole, ditch, or other excavation in a public place to have a suitable barricade at all times and sufficient lights at night to protect humans and animals. We found examples of accumulated human waste and drug paraphernalia in Civic Center Park. And at Overland Pond Park, we found a large rotten tree adjacent to a picnic table and a walkway. Through a hole in the tree trunk, the pond on the other side was visible. The hole and signs of disease predisposed the tree to falling over. And due to the immediate safety risk, we made a report of a hazardous tree in the park. Photos of hazardous conditions are found on page 27 and 27, excuse me, pages 27 and 28 of the audit report. And Appendix E on page 56 includes additional photos taken during the audit or conducted site evaluations. After we completed our park evaluations, we requested the department's most recent evaluation for 12 of the same parks we visited. We received 9 evaluations, and we noticed that most of them were completed after our request and on 2 different versions of the evaluation form. Neither version matched the one previously provided to us. Still, agency management stated that all districts use the same form. The differences between the versions include missing photos, which illustrate failing park conditions, and inconsistencies in how some park features are evaluated. One version did not have the information necessary to grade and score park features, including what constitutes a passing score. As shown with this graphic found on page 54 of the report, of the 9 evaluations we received, we found that 2 parks passed, 4 failed, and 3 were completed on the version without information to score the results. Therefore, of the 6 evaluations which could be scored, 2/3 of sites failed the department's own evaluation. However, management should communicate necessary information about quality standards so employees may perform key roles and achieve objectives. Currently, maintenance districts may not be conducting evaluations consistently or collecting the information necessary to address risks and achieve the Legacy Fund objective to develop, improve, and maintain new and existing parks. As a result, monitoring and review procedures are inadequately designed to detect and correct park maintenance conditions which fail to meet its own evaluation standards. Meanwhile, the 2A 5-year plan identifies more than $130 million in deferred maintenance projects and further explains that city residents believe maintenance of existing assets is a high priority. In 2019, though, $1.2 million in parks legacy funds were spent on capital maintenance and more than $5 million on acquisitions. Recent news reports that the department is operating with fewer staff and reducing services like mowing and picking up trash less frequently. The COVID-19 pandemic impacted the city's general fund, and the Department of Parks and Recreation reduced its budget by nearly $11 million, with more than $9 million of those reductions attributed to hiring fewer part-time seasonal employees for park maintenance, keeping full-time positions vacant, and closing recreation centers. These reductions resulted in about 100,000 fewer park maintenance hours in 2020. Despite existing park assets failing to meet agency standards and service levels being reduced, the department continues to acquire new park assets, which will also require maintenance. While recognizing the pandemic affected agency staffing, the 2A 5-year plan states that it is essential to catch up and keep up on maintaining and improving existing parks, trails, facilities, and amenities to bring them up to current standards. Additionally, as we found in the 2021 city budget, the department made goals in response to taxpayer funds in 2013 for current parks to pass 80% of maintenance standards by the end of 2019. Despite these commitments, site evaluations completed by the auditor's office and the Department of Parks and Recreation show that current maintenance efforts are not sufficient to ensure park conditions pass agency standards, or that hazards are quickly identified and corrected. The department is not achieving the 2A five-year plan goal to catch up and keep up on the maintenance of all parks. Research cited by the U.S. Department of Justice explains that good park maintenance and adequate staffing protect parks over time because declining park conditions create the opportunity for antisocial behavior. Signs of disorder such as graffiti, vandalism, and dog waste are perceived by would-be offenders and other park users as indicators that the park is not cared for. The National Recreation and Park Association says that the perception of park safety is as important as actual safety. Furthermore, crime and fear of crime can be a barrier to park use. While park and land use organizations advocate for more and better parks within a 10-minute walk from home, the research notes that greater access may not lead to greater use because the perception of safety is a key element for the use of parks. Finally, according to the 2A five-year plan, safety is one of six criteria used to determine how legacy and general funds are invested in deferred maintenance, new projects, equipment, materials, staffing, and contract services. While the department operates with fewer staff resources and a growing park system, the demand overload, lack of control, and insufficient reward can make a workplace prone to burnout. This affects both the individual and the employer and lost productivity and job turnover. Work overload or questions of fairness may negatively impact the department's ability to retain staff and their institutional knowledge. However, operational success is only possible when the right personnel have the right training, tools, structures, incentives, and responsibilities. Workforce planning enables an agency to strategically meet current and future needs and prevent unnecessary disruptions. Workforce analysis includes identifying key positions and competencies, evaluating current staff, forecasting staff necessary for future needs, and evaluating the gap between available competent staff and the future need for competent staff to achieve objectives. As the agency evolves, leadership should take appropriate action to ensure staff quickly adapt, perform efficiently and effectively, meet the needs and expectations of residents, and work together with new employees as a high-performing team. The Department of Parks and Recreation's leadership acknowledged the pandemic affected their budget and the reduced funding had a big impact on the department's staffing. Leadership also said that additional staff resources are limited because of the ordinance's restrictions against supplanting. Ultimately, though, the department's own 2A five-year plan says that operational investments in staffing, contract services, equipment, materials, and supplies are necessary to deliver on legacy fund, deferred maintenance, and capital projects. The ordinance prohibits supplanting. However, the city's informal definition of supplanting only prohibits replacing general funds with legacy funds without reappropriating the money. While agency leadership explained that budget changes are included in the annual process, management should continually monitor activities in place to achieve objectives and be responsive to change so issues are evaluated and appropriately corrected on a timely basis. Parks and Recreation stated their processes ensure progress is demonstrated towards achieving the legacy fund goals. However, while time remains in the initially planned five-year period, the agency is unable to demonstrate now that efforts ensure existing parks are safe and maintained to its own standards. While Parks and Recreation cites decreased general funds as the cause for reduced park maintenance service levels, from 2019 alone, the department retained more than $14 million in legacy funds budgeted for acquisitions and park development. While ordinance defines allowable expenses, including acquisitions of land, developing, improving, and maintaining new and existing parks, and operating and maintaining acquisitions and capital improvements to the park system, the ordinance does not define how legacy funds should be divided amongst the allowable expenses. Similarly, the city's definition of supplanting restricts reallocating costs to use other sources of funding, but no text prohibits the department from budgeting both general and legacy funds for maintenance staff and using only the funds necessary to maintain operational standards. The U.S. Department of Justice explains more generally that supplanting is when funds for an activity are reduced because another source of funds is available or expected to be available. If a question of supplanting arises, a department is required to show they reduced the primary source of funds for a reason other than the receipt or planned receipt of an additional source. For example, a local government experiencing reduced revenue because of a public health crisis could instead use federal funds as a secondary source. If questions arise about supplanting, the local government can show revenue is lower for a reason other than the expectation of federal resources. Regardless, the department's definition of supplanting is not documented in a formal policy, but management is responsible for designing and building policies and procedures to fit an entity's circumstances as an integral part of the operations. We have four recommendations for finding two. I will pause for comments and questions after reading all four. First, recommendation 2.1, found on page 34 of the audit report, states, the Department of Parks and Recreation should conduct and document a formal needs assessment to determine how to ensure parks are maintained properly and park hazards are quickly identified and corrected. The needs assessment should analyze existing and future maintenance needs, as well as the necessary frequency for conducting on-site park evaluations to achieve agency goals and strategic plans. In combination with other planning data, the department should use the results of the needs assessment to inform decisions related to the use of the Park Legacy Fund. The Department of Parks and Recreation agreed to implement this recommendation by March 31st, 2022. Based upon the department's official response, we provided additional information applicable to recommendation 2.1 in an auditor's addendum found on page 41 of the report. Recommendation 2.2, found on page 35 of the report, states, using the results of the needs assessment, the Department of Parks and Recreation should conduct a workforce analysis to determine appropriate staffing resources to maintain existing assets while planning for the anticipated growth of the park system. The results of the workforce analysis and other planning data should be used to inform decisions related to the use of the Park Legacy Fund. The Department of Parks and Recreation agreed to implement this recommendation by June 30th, 2022, to align with the 2022 budget process. Again, based upon the department's official response, we provided additional information applicable to recommendation 2.2 in the auditor's addendum found on page 41 of the report. Recommendation 2.3, also found on page 35 of the report, states the Department of Parks and Recreation should identify a single evaluation form and train staff to conduct site evaluations following a standardized process to ensure parks are evaluated by the same quantitative and qualitative standards. In combination with other planning data, the department should use the results of the site evaluations to inform decisions related to the use of the Parks Legacy Fund. The Department of Parks and Recreation agreed to implement this recommendation by March 31st, 2022. Based upon the department's official response, we provided additional information applicable to recommendation 2.3 in the auditor's addendum found on page 41 of the report. Lastly, recommendation 2.4, which is also found on page 35 of the report, states the Department of Parks and Recreation should work with the city attorney's office to formalize the definition of supplanting as it relates to the Parks Legacy Fund ordinance. The Department of Parks and Recreation agreed to implement this recommendation by March 31st, 2022. This concludes the presentation of finding two, so I will now pause to allow for questions and comments.
Any questions from the audit committee? Okay, Scott, anything to add to what you've already got on the record here?
I just appreciate, you know, the evaluations and highlighting the challenges of managing a very large park system, and the acknowledgement that we have been struggling through a very hard time in this world with the global pandemic and the impacts that it's had on our public spaces. I want to acknowledge that our public spaces are critical to the well-being of the citizens of this city and the visitors that come and spend time here. And it is critical that we do have safe and clean spaces that the public gets to visit. So I appreciate everything you guys have brought up. And we know that the Parks and Rec Department takes a lot of pride in our park system. And we feel we have one of the best park systems, not only in the country, but the world. But this does highlight that it is incredibly challenging to manage these public spaces. So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you. Any other comments? All right, moving right along, general business. I know I've distributed to the audit committee the 2022 audit plan. Valerie, did you want to go over the audit plan? Or first, maybe I should ask, are there any questions from the audit committee about the audit plan for 2022? You all liked it, I guess. Okay. Next item. Our next audit committee meeting is scheduled for 9 a.m. on Thursday, November the 18th. It will be held virtually. We look forward to resuming in person, but until the numbers, the statistics for the city look better, we'll be doing these virtually. With that, I'd like to adjourn into an executive session to have an entrance conference with our external auditors, BDO, Moss Adams, and BKD. So is there a motion to go into executive session?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Okay.
Is there any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 We are in executive session.
The Car Guy Channel. The Car Guy Channel. My name is Mike Hennessy. This show is all about cars and all four car guys.
Keep yourself a cold beer. Keep yourself a cold beer, guys, because our show is... Okay! We are smoking!
I'm Mike Hennessy, and you're watching the Car Guy Channel. I have an auto repair shop. I've been in the business for over 30 years. You name it, we got it, we built it, we've done it, we do it. We love this car stuff, and I hope you guys do too. We're going to have a lot of fun, got a lot of stuff cooking, so just stay tuned.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock.
Welcome to the Car Guy Channel. We got a fantastic show. I got all types of neat things to show you and show you what's going to be coming up in some of our next episodes. We've got the Mercedes 190 coming up. And, of course, we're going to have what we call the Bicycle of the Week, which is really isn't true. But this right here is an LE. This is a Lee Iacocca design electric bicycle that I got originally from the San Jose Grand Prix. Grand Prix gave me a bike for some of the work we did there through Chrysler and the whole event. But if you remember the San Jose Grand Prix back in San Jose, it was a spectacular event. I thought it was really pretty cool. But we got stuff to show you. I got the machine. We got a V8 Jaguar. We got a Mercury. We got a Firebird we did for my good buddy Kevin. Check these things here out. Two things you got to do. Get yourself a cold one, sit down, and enjoy the show. I got these four cars out of my collection, but there's one car that I want to show you that I just got. It's absolutely spectacular. We're going to go through this. So we got some pictures to show you of the 1998 Jaguar XJS convertible. Underneath the hood, something a little bit different because it's my new driver I'm going to be using. You see me tooling around town in that car? It's really pretty neat. But if you remember one of the episodes, I had the 1969 Rambler Scrambler. I got this car as a great estate sale, and I picked it up back east. Got the car delivered, and we did a full episode on it, and great comments, and people said, have I ever heard of the machine? Yes, I've heard of the machine. And of course, this here is a 1970 machine, AMC machine. And we got a Pontiac Firebird we did for a client, and I got to show you the 52 Mercury. It's absolutely spectacular. So let's start in on the Jag, and I'm going to take you around. Here's a 1998 Jaguar XJS convertible. This car here is a lot of story behind it, a lot of really good stuff. Got it from a very, very good customer. The motor was put in this car maybe about 20 years ago from a company over back in Ceres, California. The motor is actually an LT1 Corvette engine, and we went ahead and fine-tuned it, but the problem we ran into was the computer. The computer did not last in this car. We finally got a computer in here, redid a lot of the wiring on it, painted it. And I'm going to tell you, these are spectacular because rack and pinion steering, they have fully independent suspension, a little bit more like what a newer Corvette really would be. These cars here handle and they drive really well, but there's just nothing like the coachwork and the class and the style of a Jaguar. So let's get under the hood and check this LT1 out, and I'm going to show you, this is absolutely a spectacular car. Now, this LT1 Corvette engine was specially chosen for these cars because they have a real low plenum. And the plenum manifold is so low, so when you close the hood, you really have a lot of clearance for these type of Jaguar conversions. Perfect transplant for them. They got the mass airflow sensor up in the front, the air cleaner switches over there. Now, something that's really kind of interesting on this car, we put the computer system right over here. Keeps it nice and cool, and that's where all the wiring goes. That right there was really quite a bit of the challenge of doing this car, but as dual electric fans, has air conditioning, single drive pulley belt on the front, of course has alternator, air conditioning, all the stuff on it, and it's really just a neat way to go about it because the V12s, I don't want to say were undependable, are not very powerful for what they were. They were a real massive large engine, and the V12 really takes up a lot of space, and there's just really nothing about the performance I can say just to be on positive side of the LT1 engine. This right here is pumping out pretty much about 370 horsepower, and the V12 Jag had nowhere near that type of horsepower. They were barely breaking 240. And when you get it in a car like this here, it makes it drive absolutely spectacular with the handling, the weight distribution, how the motor is set into the car. We made a lot of changes on it when we did it. So I could show you here, this is just, if you ever have the opportunity to do one or get into one, these are really a fun project and they're really cool. And I'll tell you something, it's a win-win with a Jag and an LT1. Now, we did not do a color change. This is originally a factory Jaguar red. The red is a real deep, lustrous red. I say it all the time on the show. Pretty cool to have a camera that can pick up the luster of a lot of colors. We just finished painting this car. We did it in a base coat clear. And obviously, like I said, it was done in the original color red, the original Jaguar red, to keep it kind of neat. But what other color would you choose for something like this? Black is always great, but Jaguar had a lot of pretty cool colors. And I think they were a stylish automobile. But the car is straight as an arrow all the way down the sides. Rick went ahead and squirted this car here, put the clear on, color sanded it, called me up and said, Mike, I think we're ready to take that Jaguar for a drive. Check out the color now and the lines on this car. Just spectacular. Jaguar is one of the companies that had a lot of class. A lot of European cars have a lot of class. Their coachwork, I think, is spectacular. But one of the most neatest parts, really, about the European cars, they were kind of really the first to do what they call a cloth top. Another term for it's called hearthless, is a type of breed of material that they do use. And it almost looks like it's cloth. Actually, it is. It's a type of cloth. And water does not penetrate it at all. And it's a real classy look because it's kind of a, oh, it's kind of a soft, it's a, the color of it's a little bit on the semi-glossy side than regular vinyl top would be. And this right here is all hand stitched, and they have a glass back window and of course a defroster back window. And the way they fit on the car, the look they have is just spectacular. That's really neat. And of course, getting into one, we replaced all the wood and the seats, and check this out. Now these door panels are all Jaguar leather, and they're just spectacular looking. And a guy in my shop named Danny Kay, he handles all putting them on, taking care of them. The cleanup on these was, you know, just to do a lot of work to soak them down with all the right materials and leather food to go ahead and make them look nice. And then some areas needed to be recolored, so we recolored some of it with actual the leather dye, the correct dye that you would use to cover these seats and carpets and whatnot in the car. But we replaced all the wood trim. You can see the whole wood package. I got it out of a company out of North Carolina, and they went ahead and redo all the stuff in the car for the wood. And the hours it takes to do this, you know, it's always not about the money sometimes. It's finishing a really, really cool project. And I think Estelle's going to get a good view of how the wood through a whole car looks, the doors, the center console, and the dash. Check it out. I just think it's just gorgeous. You can see these seats are just fantastic looking. And of course, you can see the workmanship. These seats are handmade by my personal upholstery man, Gustavo, which I think does everything in the planet to make these cars all look great. And the hand stitching on them. And look at the complexity of the seat itself, the way the back is with the pleats down the center and the wing type sides on it. Same with the seat on the bottom. And there's just nothing like it. It's just beautiful to me. I think it just shows total class, and they are comfortable. And they have chrome handles on them. And it was just really kind of neat all the way around. And actually, when you're in this car, you feel like you're really in a car, like you're, it's like you're sitting on a giant's hand. They're just fantastic. You know, they crush you right in, and you're ready to drive. Europeans' touch to actual detail of interior of a car is astounding. They're just spectacular, I always say. Plus, we put all new rubber all the way around the whole car, brand new carpets in here for the trunk. Then they have a spare tire. They have a cover for them. We left the cover off the battery just to show you where the battery is actually implanted in this car. The cover that goes over to it is the same type of the material that's all covered on it, just like it would be inside the trunk. But their attention to detail with the Europeans, I think, just do such a great job with it. And to me, it's a real big plus for me on this car, and it kind of helped makes it what it is. And you know, when you show cars, see all the cars, I think trunk is very, very important when they're detailed out, when they look really nice. This right here is detailed out. I think it trimmed out really, really cool. Check it out. For you folks out there that have a good keen eye for attention to detail, you're going to notice Hop and Jag. So I thought it was kind of a pretty cool plate to keep in the car. It's December of 2011. As you can see, it's been in my collection for quite a while before we get these things on the road, but we did. Now, there's one little item that I put on this car. It took me a while to find it. Found it on the internet. I mean, Amazon has everything. I hate to say that, but Amazon does not have a V8 Jaguar Roadster, but I got an emblem that says LT1 5.7 liter. I think that was pretty cool. You know, after driving a Jaguar with an LT1, you know, going 0 to 60 in about 4.5 to 5 seconds, it's really kind of fun to do. But there's a car I picked up in my collection I really want to show you. It's a Rambler Rebel. Rambler Rebels came out in 1970, and they were just a very, very unusual car. And let's check this Rambler Rebel out. I got to show it to you. It's new in my project and new in my team of cars. Got to show it. If you caught one of my episodes a little while back when I picked up a little Rambler Scrabbler, 1969 car, red, white, and blue, I think they're just really cool, a lot about America, and I always wanted to have that in my collection. And when you change some cars in your collection, if you're into car collecting, you know, they do take up space, you do take up a lot of stuff, but when you want to kind of piece your pieces around, and after a while, you know, you get rid of one because you're kind of tired of it. It's just like getting rid of your tricycle, your bicycle, and then going to a 10-speed, and so on and so on. Or a Swin to a Specialized. realized that's about how I could relate it to everybody. But the cars, I'm hard selling my wife Susan on that one, but we're working on it. But this right here happens to be a 1970 machine. They're called a Rebel machine. These are just an extremely fascinating car, and they have a lot of American history besides the red, white, and blue. Now, they did team up with Hearst when they designed these cars, but it was not a Hearst car like the Rambler Scrambler really was actually teamed up with Hearst. Hearst did help some of the design on the car, but it's not labeled as a Hearst car. They only made 2,380 of these particular cars. And, of course, with the color combination, they claim 1,000 were done with the red, white, and blue stickers. And these right here were custom made originally by 3M products. So that's when they teamed up with 3M to go ahead and make these cars red, white, and blue. And the designers for this car, all they really believed the whole American world, which I do too, and they really wanted to put that into a car. So when they made a 1970 Rambler and they go turn this Rebel into this monstrous beast, it's great for the drag strips. And they had things like the Rambler had 1969, 1970 had the thing that's called 19. 19 really, group 19 really means 19 different options. And that has to mean with different type of springs, different type of cam lifters, had all sorts of different things for it, and the type of four-speed, close ratio or wide ratio, same with the rear end on the car. So 1970, they still did offer the thing called Group 19. And this car here happens all the Group 19 stuff. And when we pop the hood, there's one item you're gonna see that's not there. In a real Group 19 car did not have power steering. Now, some people kind of debated that and some not, talked to some experts, did some homework. So when I bought this car, I really wanted to know all about it as much as I possibly could. This does have the BorgWarner four-speed transmission. A few of them came with automatics, but when I show you under the hood, I'll talk about some horsepower, and you're going to start to like one of these. What makes these cars so distinctive and so rare and collectible, and some people have actually forgot about them because you really didn't see many on the road. You don't see many of these out there. When you do, it's a thumbs up. I can't tell you all the people that have enjoyed seeing it. And Susan, my wife, would be seeing it for the first time on the show, so I got some explaining to do. But the hood on the car, these actually are functional Ram Air for the hood itself. And on the other side of the hood, Estelle will get you a shot of that, the other side is actually the tack. Tachometer, just like you would see on a Pontiac Firebird or GTO that had hood tacks on the cars. This happened, and the same manufacturer just had to redesign the needle and the faceplate a little bit to make it fit inside here. And let's take a look underneath the hood. I think you're going to be pretty impressed. I was mentioning what the hood scoop does. Now, this is a vacuum-operated solenoid. When this solenoid goes ahead and gets vacuum to it, it opens up vents inside here and closes the vents when you don't need them. And that's good for ram air induction. Then you're going to ask me, all you guys out there and gals are pretty sharp about this, where's the induction air cleaner? We do have the induction air cleaner set aside. We put this here on really for driving and going to a few events. We didn't really need that on the car. That's really why we left it off. We're doing some service work to it. But these are a 390 engine cubic inch, and they have 340 horsepower from the factory in 1970. These cars right here would do the quarter mile in 14 seconds, which is really just spectacular for what they can do them on. And they were drag cars, and that's really what they were meant to be, and that's how they drove these on the road. And that's what the whole sales pitch was about it. When these were on the showroom floor, most of the dealers used them to take them for promo for AMC to show their other models of cars, like the Rebel and the Matador and quite a few other models that they had out. And this right here was a marquee car. And they were designed originally when they made a little over 2,000 cars. This car right here fits the mold of how many dealerships they really actually had. They wanted each dealer to have one. So when a guy went down to buy one, now you're going to ask, what is a car like this here cost? This car back then cost just a little over $3,000. Yes, $3,000. See what you get for $3,000. You get a 390 with 340 horsepower. And this car happens to have power brakes on it. And just take a look at the simplicity of under the hood. Now, they originally came with an Autolite carburetor, what they did come with. This happens to be changed with a Holley, which a lot of people have done, and it doesn't really change really the world of them unless you're going to a certain type of concourse judging. I just really like the car, and I might go ahead and pick up the Autolite someday if I really know to take that thing. But, of course, I changed my cars quite a bit, and right now I kind of like owning the Rambler Scrambler and, of course, the machine. For some of you GoPros out there, this right here, you can actually tell this is a unibody car. And of course, most of the Rambler products really were a unibody, and that's where really the originators for how they really made unibodies. The factory was really set up and designed for them, and all the body runs into here. Frame rails are actually attached to it, and this right here is the tunnel for the upper spring, and there's the shock. And if you notice, down in front, no power steering. The real racer cars did not have power steering for the weight, and they really didn't want the steering to be that easy to flow on it, even though it's a quick steering box. I'm telling you, this is the way to go. Pretty cool. definitely old school. As you can see, there's three areas where the word "the machine" is actually on. It's on both front fenders, and it's actually on the back of the deck lid. But the word "the machine," some people claim that BMW actually liked the name "the machine," and they went ahead and wrote theirs as the ultimate driving machine. But Rambler, AMC, and you guys were on top of it. Got it. Looks great on the car. As you can see, the dash and the nickname for a dash like this is called the taxi cab interior. Taxi cab interior means it's pretty darn plain. There's really no frills in these cars. They didn't have tilt and telewheel. They didn't have any power windows, and they didn't have none of those types of stuff. This car happens to have a heater, which a lot of them did. And some were heater delete that really took the drag racing kind of serious, but this car happens to have a heater. And there's a they have a BorgWarner transmission in them. It's a four-speed. This happens to be a close ratio box. And if you notice on the center console, where you rest your arm, they couldn't help it but get the red, white, and blue on there, and you gotta love it. But the dash, again, is very simple inside the car. Bucket seats strap you down. What kind of gets me is cars back then did not put four-point shoulder harnesses in them and all these other things that they're requesting to do. But there are different times and different date in our lives, but this car here, believe it or not, you just go right down the showroom floor, take it over to drag strip, and you had a lot of fun that night. There's no doubt about it. These rims in this car were actually known as Rebel wheels. They were known as machine wheels is what people would, the nickname, and it kind of stuck to them. And these wheels were made by a company called Kelsey Hayes. They made a lot of specialty rims for all the automakers. Fantastic company, come up with a lot of great stuff. But here's the trick to this. These beauty rings are one and only for these type of rims. And the beauty ring is designed so the wheel weight can be hammered into the rim and sit over the beauty ring, if you can see that. I thought that was just a clever idea. It's very neat. And these are the only cars that have them. Now, a car called a Javelin and a few other models, you were allowed to order what they call the machine Kelsey Hayes rims. They're done in the satin silver, and they actually have the stainless steel beauty ring. I really go for the odd of the unusual and the specialty cars. My collection's kind of changing a little bit, and I kind of like something that's just so unique and just really a pleasure to look at and part of history, and this is definitely 100% part of history. And the Rebel came out with this particular car. It was just a great idea. The first car came out for this on a test design was obviously would be a 70 body style for the Rebel, but they came out in 1969. They changed a 390 motor with 500 horsepower, and the car definitely was black on black. And the hood was a flat black, and there's actually only one in existence. Then they came out with another car called Big Mean Green. That was a three green cars. They claimed there's only one of them in existence also. So just when you get a chance to see these things out there, they're really neat to appreciate, and you don't see them every day. But I will have it at the Veterans Day Parade. I'll take two of my cars out there that will have drivers in them. Nothing About America and a red, white, and blue Rebel. Your boss just came by, and I said, I never met you before, have I?
No, we haven't met.
We haven't been that fortunate, have we?
No, we haven't.
Now, how long have you been here?
I've been about a year and a half now.
Now, I asked him earlier, how does he hire?
Mm-hmm.
When you came in for your job here, what was your qualifications come in?
Well, I just came in, basically had a good reference from my buddy Mark, and talked to Mark here for a little bit about just my overall car knowledge, and he felt comfortable with me.
Hey, what the hell is your car knowledge?
My car knowledge, I do a lot of four-wheel drive stuff, building some small projects right now, but...
So if a guy's got a 4x4 thing, you can help answer questions that one of these other techs can't.
Exactly.
Good. Now, how old are you?
I'm 24.
24 years old. Do you want to make this a career? Is what you're working on?
I'm trying to work into it, yeah.
It's kind of cool, though, isn't it? There's some money to make in it.
There is.
Plus, you got to admit it. This is fun.
It's fun stuff. It is.
Yeah.
I do enjoy getting up and coming to my job in the morning.
And the other thing is he gets a lot of his parts at wholesale.
Exactly.
We're probably,
projects a little easier.
And we're kind of our own enemy sometimes because, we're trying to get our parts going. And,
exactly.
But you learn what's hot, what's not, mm-hmm. what's new, what's exciting, and what's new that works that don't work.
Mm-hmm.
From customers and whatnot.
Oh, yeah.
Good, buddy. Good job. We'll be seeing you through. And you got my orders coming through on the car, so get that stuff at my shop ASAP. I basically take precedence over any customer.
Sounds good.
Sounds good. Well, Elijah will. Now, this particular 1968 Pontiac Firebird coupe is not one of my cars. It's not in my collection. I've had many of them in the past. I love them all, the 67 to the 68 to the 69. Those are kind of my favorite years, really, for the Firebird model car. The reason why I'm showing you this, this has the new updated air conditioning. It took us 2 to 3 days, maybe a little longer, to get it installed because it's really kind of a new design, actually, from Vintage Air. The reason why I'm showing it to you is really, I don't want to say how simple it is to put in. It's not, but how simple it looks when it's under the hood. You can see the tubes go underneath inside the fender, how to get into the inside of the car. The installation on this car, I'm telling you, my guys really knocked this out of the park. I think they did a great job. So I want you to check underneath the hood of this. You see where we put the condenser, the receiver dryer, air compressor, and how clean this is. And this right here is a good buddy of mine. It's Kevin Moore, so I have to say this on the air. Kevin Moore, I love you, buddy. Now, we did a lot of work here for Kevin. Now, Kevin was great to work with because he shows up, he's in all the time, and it really helps us really get what he wants. A lot of you guys out there and gals restoring a car, you're having a shop do it, a friend do it, stay in touch. Kevin, God bless you. Stayed in touch, and that makes the job better. If there's an avenue we're going on, you might want to go a different way. Here's a perfect example. Here's a hood to the car. Now, this right here is an original Firebird Formula hood with emblems for 400, scoops and everything on it that go on the top. We'll show you in a minute. But Kevin wanted an original one. He did not want an OER type hood that the companies sell. We did not go that avenue. We searched, found one on Craigslist, and went over and picked up the hood. And I think Kevin made the right decision. Let's show you the tack. We did all sorts of work in this car. Let's take a look at the tack. If you notice, this hood tack, this is a whole unit that actually bolts to the hood. And there's a special template you use that goes on the hood to cut the opening out. And it's a really, it sounds like it's easy, but it does take a challenge to do it, to get it in the right spot. We got the right measurements from here to from heel to toe and from side to side, really where this needs to be sat. And of course, this, the hood kind of comes at an angle, but you need this to be straight to the driver. So there's really a lot to do this and do it properly. We obviously painted it to match the hood itself and the tack in here. Now, like I mentioned earlier, on the machine, that there's a manufacturer who made these, and it's the same manufacturer who made the ones for the machine, made them for the Pontiac Firebirds, Trans Ams, and of course the GTOs. This is spectacular. It's really neat. Great touch. You can notice inside of this car here is black, and I think it's just a great color combination with the yellow and the black interior. Some people mentioned about putting a black vinyl top on it. It'd have its own look, its own flair, but for some reason this is clean. And I didn't mention this earlier, but Kevin's car, he's original owner. His family bought it in 1968. It was handed down to him throughout the years. He had it at his house. He finally came in and says, I got to get this thing roadworthy on the road. What can we do? So we took this motor apart, put new timing chain, new gears, new front cover, water pump, fuel pump was electric fuel pump. Some work was done on it before. We remodified the car back to original as much as possible by having a good mechanical fuel pump and, of course, wiring things in the front of the car. And then Kevin just didn't, he just couldn't stop. I mean, he's like a kid in a candy store. He goes, let's get the front seats done. Let's get the new carpets in the car. And we went ahead and got a different center console because this car here originally was a six-cylinder car. If you remember, the Pontiac had the overhead cam six-cylinder. The motors are kind of rare, but they're very, you know, they were very finicky in the tooling for them, and they just really didn't meet the mark of what we needed to have. So this was changed over to a 400 Pontiac motor back in the earlier years. But we remodified the car to bring it up to date and current things that we can get. So the transmission was a two-speed automatic. This car here came with a two-speed, but when the motor transplant was done, they did a nice job. Kevin did a good job, but they went ahead and put in a turbo 400 transmission, which is actually what it should have being a 400 car. So we had to change the shifter in the center of the car. We put a whole new 400 shifter in the middle of it. The air conditioning is built into the dash, new carpets, new seats, emblems all the way around the car. Kevin, this is pretty cool. But doing a 1968 automobile, some cars don't have a lot of reproduction parts. Pontiac is a little bit on the lower end of what you can get, but we were able to find the 400 emblem that actually goes on the trunk. Now, on the back of the deck lid here, it's not the same emblem that goes on the hood of the car that says 400 on the side of the scoops. This one took a little time to get. They were literally on back order, but they are reproducing. So doing a car like this really made the job kind of easy when we were able to get some parts. From the machine to Firebird to Jaguar, we're going to take you over to 1953 Mercury. This car to me is just spectacular. I love the stainless, love the lines on it. It actually has a Ford flathead engine in it, a three-speed on the column. Now, there was an automatic actually for that year coming out, but this car did not have it. But look how clean the lines are, the mint green, the wide white wall tires, and the rims are painted red. There's just a lot about this car I really like and love, and I'm telling you, it's a different type of appeal that people really like. A lot of these have been out there, have been hot rodded, street rodded, and do lower the Merc and do all that stuff. American Graffiti had Mercury in there, kind of lowered and slammed, and that's the way these things go and get done. In this case here, left it like this. Looks really nice. And the neat thing about these is they're fun and they're great to drive. Now, if you notice, all these emblems here, these right here, all been re-chromed. A lot of stuff is not reproduced for this particular model, like the Ado for cars, like a 57 Chevy and 55, 56. And, of course, the Mustangs, you almost get a complete car. But with this here, all the stainless and stuff is all polished and stuff. It looks really, really nice. All the stainless is in excellent condition. Interior's great. Color's great. Let's take you inside and check it out. If you notice, inside this car is kind of a real simple look. But